Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Sairam, dear listener, and welcome back to our continuing series on Dharma, presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Today we present Professor's talk number 4 in the current series. Over to Professor Venkatraman.
Loving Sairam, and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. This is my 4th talk in the current series on Dharma and my 3rd on the opening chapter of the book by Gurcharan Das, which comes after a prelude on which my 1st talk was based. That is to say, this talk started with the discussion of the prelude, then moved on to chapter 1, which is titled Duryodhana's Envy. And this is my 3rd talk on chapter 1 titled Duryodhana's Envy. All of that should indicate how much there is in that chapter that requires careful examination. Now, starting with Duryodhana's envy, Das goes on in that chapter to take a close look at the role that envy and jealousy play, among other things, in A, the market, and B, politics as shaped by current socio-economics. Thus far, I have not commented on these aspects, and so let me now turn to them. I begin with an interesting story narrated by Das of the bitter rivalry between two of India's richest men who also happen to be brothers. The story of these brothers, in a sense, begins in the late 1960s when their father, who at that time was a man of modest means and was actually living in a single-room apartment in a crowded slum of Bombay, now called Mumbai. Starting as a trader in synthetic yarn, this father, thanks to his sharp business instinct, soon became a billionaire, not a millionaire, billionaire. And when he died in 2002, his empire passed on to his two sons. Bitter conflict and rivalry soon developed between the brothers, but some kind of a rapprochement was later reached following an intervention by their mother. Currently, as Das tells us, each brother is worth more than double that of the undivided kingdom. That is to say, what his father owned at the time he passed away. Each brother is having twice of that right now. That's how rich they are. The question can be asked, okay, there are so many cases like this. What's so special about poor people becoming rich? Luckily for me, Das himself has given the answer, and here it is, quote, "It is a classic rags to riches story, the ascent of a simple village boy who, against all odds, creates a world-class, globally competitive enterprise that brings enormous property to millions. But it's also a tale of deceit, bribery, and the manipulation of a decayed and corrupt license raj." End of quote. The term license raj is a reference to the highly controlled economic system that existed in India prior to the introduction of economic reforms in 1990. Elsewhere, Das says that the family adopted corrupt practices not only during the license raj, but even after controls were substantially relaxed. In other words, corrupt practice had become a way of life in the family. Das adds, and I quote, "The defenders of the family argue that since the father's enterprises brought so much good to society, what was the harm if he manipulated an evil system and bribed politicians and bureaucrats? The government itself realized its problems and has been dismantling the system since 1991. But the opponents of the family counter all this by saying, it is never justified to break a law, hence cannot justify the means ever. Others believe that business is very uncertain today. It's full of danger and surprise, and therefore a certain amount of deception is necessary for success in business. Cheating is necessary in business, some people say. So we have here an interesting mix of personal envy, family intrigue, deceit, bribery, etc. In short, flagrant violation of man-made laws as well as the laws of dharma. Three different views have been expressed about all these happenings, two of them being similar and a defense of malpractice, while the third one is sharply critical. So it's 2:1. I am drawing attention to all this because we see here how actions of individuals can impact society. I mean, if people begin to get the feeling that wealth can be acquired only via deceit, then most people who wish to become rich would begin to believe that dishonesty is the royal road to follow. Clearly, such an attitude can and indeed does hugely disrupt society. Envy, says Das, has a positive or a healthy side as well as a negative and a destructive side. The positive side is what triggers growth, and in as much as competition promotes growth, creates jobs, etc., positive envy is not a bad thing, so says Das. Frankly, it's a very thin line that divides envy into a type that is beneficial and one which is not only far from good but also leads onto a slippery slope. In my living memory, I have seen people in high places. I have seen rich people. All of them are honest and scrupulous. But lately, society has changed so fast that people these days often argue that if wealth can generate employment for millions, then why complain about some hanky-panky here and there? Let me tell you, I belong to the old school, which demanded that not only must one be good, but also be seen to be good. Once this premise is given up and society is ready to turn a blind eye to hanky-panky on the ground that the country's wealth would grow, that jobs would be created and so on, it would not be long before money power starts eating the moral roots of society and society as a whole itself begins to decay. Just as termites destroy trees by attacking the roots, so also society would begin to decay when evil begins to attack its moral roots. That is to say, society's moral roots. And past experience tells us that a failed society is the equivalent of a dead tree. I now wish to direct attention to the deep connection that exists between the means and the end. Those who believe that being good comes before earning wealth firmly hold on to the view that ends cannot ever justify the means. How can one get a sweet mango by planting a seed of neem, they ask. And they further say, can a neem seed ever produce a mango tree? Think about it. That being said, businessmen and politicians who do not bat an eyelid in doing whatever needs to be done to achieve their goals say in private very freely, look, maybe you don't quite agree with the means I employ to achieve my goals. But look at the other side of the ledger. Have you noticed how many jobs I have created and thereby lifted so many people and families out of poverty? I want to spread wealth, and this I do by generating first wealth for myself. Okay, here and there I do cut corners, but why make a big fuss about it? Look at the result. Can you deny how many thousands of jobs I have created? It is sometimes said, not seriously I believe, that all is fair in love and war. Now it seems to me that all is fair is in business also. That being said, to claim that ends do justify the means is, in my view, a grave mistake. In fact, it is the proverbial slippery slope in the sense that after a while, the so-called end also begins to fade away. There is no end. There is only means. There is something more interesting. A few years ago, the younger of the two brothers I referred to earlier, wrote an article in the spiritual section of a leading newspaper in India. And this article was about his late father. And in this article, this author portrays his father as a very spiritual man. This is an extract from that article about his father in the spiritual section of a leading newspaper. I quote, Karma Yogi was the other name of my father. He was a man of action, but as a true follower of the Bhagavad Gita, he acted not for himself but for humanity. In the true spirit of Nishkama Karma or selfless service, he remained free from the fruits of action. Ego is the source of all our troubles. It is, as the divine text puts it, the feeling of separateness, the sense of duality, the idea of being distinct and different from others. It is an arrogant and obsessive sense of ownership that has lost touch with Dharma. Humility, then, is neither a sign of human weakness nor just another polite virtue. It is the essential foundation for building everything that is just, lasting and permanent. This was the abiding truth that guided the life of my father. He never saw himself as an owner. I have often asked if humility and trust are matters of individual temperament, an aspect of our samskar and karma, or in today's parlance, genetic coding. Samskar means heritage. And every time I have come to the contrary conclusion. It's not easy, I admit, but we can all learn to be humble and trustful as long as we have the ability to love all beings as our own self. That is the quintessential first step in the long journey of the individual, social and spiritual evolution. Author Das, who offers this quote in his book, also adds the following. Quote, "Nevertheless, this article was also self-serving, which is ironical, since it extolled the virtue of selflessness and humility. It did not fool anyone. In fact, one shocked reader's reaction was, 'I thought only gurus write such things. Never knew billionaires could do it. If he's so motivated by the Gita and not by money, I have a simple solution. Give up everything and go to the Himalayas.'" End of quote. As Das says via the title of his book, being good is quite tough, especially in the world of today. Yes, there can be absolutely no question about that. And that is because to be good, one must never compromise on truth, honesty, integrity and concern for others, all of which unfortunately demand too high a price these days. I am sure you would argue that there exists a way of dealing with that issue. Indeed, there sure is, and we necessarily have to come to that, but that will have to be later. For the moment, let me go back to the issue of ends and means, to which I made a reference earlier. The father of the author of the spiritual article, which I just referred to, that father himself was a mighty billionaire. He made piles of money, and all of which by indulging in questionable tactics whenever he thought it was necessary. And yet, the author of the article tries to pose off his dad for a karma yogi. As Das rightly says, it fools no one, not in India anyway, because Indians know what nishkama karma, selfless action, is all about. After all, the concept of nishkama karma goes back at least 5,000 years to the days of Krishna. Agreed that it was seldom practiced in its purest form. Nevertheless, it was certainly a tradition to help the needy. Even as Christians have tried to follow the teachings of Jesus and be the keeper of one's brother, as the saying goes. Furthermore, within living memory, we had Gandhiji, who came pretty close to being a classic example of a karma yogi, dedicating his work to the larger cause of the people of his country and to humanity at large. Okay, let me now pick one incident from the Mahatma's life that tells us what we need to know about the ends and the means. Perhaps I should begin with the fact that Gandhi left India in 1893 to go to South Africa to represent a client in a legal case. For your information, Gandhi had studied law in England and was a qualified bar at law. There in South Africa, while Gandhi tried to practice law, he faced racial prejudice. That was when he began to employ satyagraha as a means of protesting non-violently. For the benefit of English-speaking audiences, Gandhi described non-violent protest as passive resistance or civil disobedience. In his own mind, however, what he was engaged in was something spiritual, as he explains in the following quote. Quote, "Truth or satya implies love, and firmness or agraha engenders as a result. Agraha serves as a synonym for force. I began to call the Indian movement, that is to say civil disobedience, as satyagraha, which means the force which is born of truth and love or non-violence. And after that I gave up the use of the phrase passive resistance in connection with my struggles. So much so that even in English writing, we have often avoided the phrase passive resistance and used instead the word satyagraha. End of quote. Now I have to go to a bit of politics and the Indian independence struggle. And the reason for that would become evident shortly. Now, in the early days of the Indian independence movement, it started off on a modest note, in fact, with some Europeans and Englishmen participating in it. And the demand at that time was for what used to be referred to as home rule. This basically said that India wanted dominion status, i.e. a status comparable to what Australia, Canada and New Zealand enjoyed at that time as a part of the British Empire. But the British were in no mood to grant any such concessions. Although during the First World War they made all sorts of promises in order to attract Indians to enroll as soldiers. In fact, over 1 million Indians served as soldiers, of whom about 70,000 plus died in action, while roughly an equal number were wounded. After the war was over in November 1918, the British not only went back on their word, but also introduced draconian laws to suppress protests by Indians. By then, Gandhiji had come back to India from South Africa, and with his arrival, the original demand for home rule was replaced by a demand for total freedom, or Purna Swaraj, as it was called. This demand for total freedom, or Purna Swaraj, infuriated the British enormously. Protests were initiated all over the country, and in 1930, as a part of the mass protest movement, Gandhiji decided to observe satyagraha against what was called the salt tax. Taxing salt was nothing new. In fact, it goes back a long time in history. And it's no wonder that the British also imposed tax on salt in India. Interestingly, no such tax was imposed in the so-called princely states like Mysore, Hyderabad and so on. Gandhi felt that the majority of Indians being very poor, it was cruel to tax salt, which was no luxury item but a vital necessity for life. Although this protest against the imposition of tax on salt might seem to have little connection with independence, Gandhi wanted to make the point that if Indians were independent, they would not be imposing such a tax, and that it was alien rule which, lacking sensitivity, imposed an oppressive tax. The only way to end such oppression was to agitate for total independence, but in a non-violent manner. That was Gandhi's reasoning for starting the salt satyagraha. Gandhi appealed to people all over the country to march to the seashore near them, collect water, boil it and make salt. The first such march was led by Gandhiji himself, starting from his base, that is to say Sabarmati Ashram near city of Ahmedabad. Gandhi took 24 days to reach the coastal village of Dandi, from where he decided to walk to the coast along with fellow marchers, draw water from the sea and produce salt. As the appointed hour approached, Gandhi addressed the volunteers, and what he said to them on that occasion was memorable. At the working level, the speech was meant to warn his followers how their march might be intercepted violently by the police, and what, according to the principles of satyagraha, the volunteers' response ought to be. Gandhiji said, "Blows would be rained and blood would flow, but you should not lift even a little finger against those who are attacking you. They are attacking you because of ignorance. For us, the principle of satyagraha is more important than merely making salt." Gandhi then quoted the last sloka of the Gita, which incidentally record the words not of Krishna, not of Arjuna, but of Sanjaya, addressed to the blind king Dhritarashtra. And this last sloka concluded Sanjaya's running commentary on the sacred dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna prior to the commencement of the Kurukshetra war. All this I am sure you know. Sanjaya says, and this is the essence, "Wherever there is Krishna, the Lord of Yoga, and along with him also Partha the archer, there, rest be assured, lie victory, prosperity, glory and justice." Gandhi added that Arjuna represented the means while Krishna represented the end. Unless, of course, in Mahabharata, Arjuna was pure, so was Krishna. Gandhiji adds, unless both the means as well as the end were pure, there would be neither victory nor glory and justice. While the end was what drove the movement, the means adopted to achieve that end were equally important. Gandhi further stressed that non-violence did not mean merely refraining from violent action. It meant one should not even think of responding with violence, be it in thought, word or deed. That was true spirit of Satyagraha. This adherence to truth in thought, word and deed is what Swami used to refer to as Trikarna Suddhi. Well, the address over, Gandhiji marched to the sea, drew water, of course accompanied by the volunteers, drew water, boiled it and made salt. It was 6:30 a.m., April 5th, 1930. Interestingly, nothing much happened, in the sense there was no police presence. That was because Lord Irwin, then the Viceroy of India, thought little of a small bunch of people marching to the sea to make salt. As he put it, I am not going to lose sleep over such trivial matters. For Gandhi, however, the Dandi March was just the beginning. From Dandi, Gandhi continued southward along the coast, produced salt everywhere and addressed meetings. Gandhi also announced that a major satyagraha would be offered in early May at a place called Darasana, about 40 kilometers south of Dandi. Not merely that, Gandhi actually wrote and informed Lord Irwin about his intention. Now by this time, the salt satyagraha had not only become national news, but also global news. The New York Times carried a front page article, besides which newspaper correspondents and newsreel film crews from many countries converged on Darasana to cover the event. Now this scared the Viceroy, and he could no longer treat the salt satyagraha lightly as he did earlier. And he immediately ordered the arrest of Gandhi. On the midnight of 4th May 1930, the district magistrate of Surat, accompanied by two Indian police officers and 30 heavily armed constables, drove to the village where Gandhi had halted for the night. This was near the coast. The police authorities then walked into a mango grove where Gandhi was sleeping on a cot under a tree. They arrested Gandhi, the authorities that is, and took him away secretly. Dawn was still many hours away and Gandhi was arrested before anyone knew what was happening. He was charged under a law enacted in 1827 that allowed police to jail people without trial on the basis that they were engaged in unlawful activities. When morning came, those who had assembled to walk along with the Mahatma found to their shock that he had already been arrested and taken away to jail. However, Satyagrahis decided to march as planned, the march being led by 76-year-old Abbas Tayabji, a retired judge. Imagine that, a retired judge was breaking the law because it was against the spirit of, you know, justice. Marching alongside Tayabji was Kasturiba Gandhi, Gandhi's wife. Both were promptly arrested and taken away, but the marchers went ahead, undeterred, led by Sarojini Naidu, a great poetess and freedom fighter. She reminded her fellow marchers, "You must not use any violence under any circumstance. You will be beaten, but you must not resist. You must not even raise a hand to ward off the blows." This was exactly as Mahatma had advised had he been there. Soon, the troops waiting for the marchers went into action and began raining blows with batons, even as camera crews that had come from overseas busily filmed this brutal attack on unarmed protesters. I believe you can see those films in the net. Webb Miller, a correspondent for United Press News Agency in America, wrote about it as follows, quote, "Not one of the marchers even raised an arm to fend off the blows. They went down like tenpins. From where I stood, I heard the sickening whacks of the club on unprotected skulls. The waiting crowd of watchers groaned and sucked in their breaths in sympathetic pain at every blow. Those struck down fell sprawling, unconscious or writhing in pain with fractured skulls or broken shoulders. In 2 or 3 minutes, the ground was quilted with bodies. Great patches of blood widened on their white clothes. The survivors, without breaking ranks, silently and doggedly marched on until struck down. Finally, the police became enraged by the non-resistance. They commenced savagely kicking the seated men in the abdomen and testicles. The injured men writhed and squealed in agony, which seemed to inflame the fury of the police. The policemen then began dragging the sitting men by arms or feet, sometimes for 100 yards, and throwing them into the ditches. End of quote. Years later, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote, and I quote, "Like most people, I had heard of Gandhi, but I had never studied him seriously. As I read, I became deeply fascinated by his campaign of nonviolent resistance. I was particularly moved by his salt march to the sea and his numerous fasts. The whole concept of satyagraha was profoundly significant to me. As I delved deeper into the philosophy of Gandhi, my skepticism concerning the power of love gradually diminished, and I came to see for the first time its potency in the area of social reform. It was in this Gandhian emphasis on love and nonviolence that I discovered the method for social reform that I had been seeking." End of quote. For Martin Luther King, Gandhi's use of nonviolence was a practical demonstration of the teaching of Jesus, who advised the attacker to show the other cheek and thus cleanse the attacker of the evil possessing him. A trip to India in 1959 helped Dr. King to connect more intimately with Gandhi's legacy. Later, King enunciated 6 key principles concerning nonviolence, which I now quote. First, one can resist evil without resorting to violence. Second, nonviolence seeks to win the friendship and understanding of the opponent, not to humiliate him. Third, evil itself and not the people committing evil acts should be opposed. Fourth, those committed to nonviolence must be willing to suffer without retaliation, as suffering itself can be redemptive. Fifth, nonviolent resistance avoids external physical violence and internal violence of spirit as well. The nonviolent resistor not only refuses to shoot his opponent, but also refuses to hate him. The resistor should be motivated by love in the sense of the Greek word agape, which means understanding or redeeming the goodwill for all men. The sixth principle is that the nonviolent resistor must have a deep faith in the future, stemming from the conviction that the universe is on the side of justice. Those are the 6 principles that Martin Luther King enunciated with respect to nonviolence. This is almost identical to what Gandhi had advocated long before King was born. Interestingly, in March 1965, Dr. King's followers had to go through a similar experience in the state of Alabama in the United States, when about 500 or so African Americans, then called Negroes, marched to protest against severe racial discrimination, or Jim Crow as it was called. Thanks to police brutality that was unleashed on the protesters that day, it has now come to be known in America as Bloody Sunday. Many of you listening might once again get the feeling I have strayed far away from where I started. Not really. You are still exploring the various outcomes of jealousy and inequity under various circumstances and spread over various times. Times may be different, times may change, but the basic human tendencies do not change substantially. Only that technology has enabled negative tendencies to get substantially amplified in recent years. Keeping all this in mind, let us go back and review the ground we have covered. And I do this review beginning with 2 slokas in chapter 2 of the Gita.
Krodat bhavati sammohaha, sammohas pratibhramaha, pratibhramshat buddhinashaha, buddhinashat pranashyati. Ragadveshaviyuktaistu vishayanindriyaischaran atmavashyairvidheyatma prasadamadhigacchati.
What you just heard are the chants of slokas 63 and 64 of chapter 2. And here is the translation. Dwelling with the mind on sense objects develops attachment. Attachment leads to desire, and desire breeds anger. From anger arises delusion. Delusion promotes confusion of the mind. and confusion of the mind generates loss of reason. And finally, loss of reason leads to complete ruin. Here, you get a crisp description of the slippery slope that takes one down like an avalanche, all the way from attachment to complete ruin. Consider Duryodhana. He coveted something that was not his, and was so intensely focused on it that his desire soon morphed into hatred for the Pandavas. And that hatred ultimately culminated in a bloody war in which all the Kauravas perished. We next consider Hitler, whose hatred for Jews was limitless. For him, the Jews in Austria and Germany were not Germans, but members of an inferior race who, through cunning and scheming, had become the cream of German society without any eligibility to it. That anger clouded Hitler's mind and made him invent the fiction that the racially inferior Jews had usurped what rightfully belonged to the racially superior Germans. As Lord Krishna foretold 5,000 years ago, once the mind becomes severely confused, there is loss of reason, and following that, total ruin. Well, Hitler's loss of reason led to World War II, in which not only 50 million were killed, but also the horrifying atomic age was born. In the above two examples, it was one man whose anger led to war and total ruin. In the first case, it was Duryodhana. In the second case, it was Hitler. Going back to the example of the Bombay trader of modest means who rose to become a billionaire, we saw that subsequently the two sons began competing fiercely, and that competition was ceased to be positive in the sense explained here. Instead, it became utterly negative and barely ethical. And the irony of it all is that the younger painted his dad as a karma yogi, i.e. one who acted always selflessly so that others could be benefited. Furthermore, a karma yogi never desired the fruits of action. No wonder one person reading the column I referred to earlier said that such stuff must come from the pen of gurus and not a market high flyer. Now, the question becomes, when there is so much moral confusion accompanied by huge loss of reason, how is one supposed to distinguish right from wrong, and what is in accordance with dharma and what is not? With reference to the fiercely competing billionaire brothers, Das says, I have always believed that it is none of my business how much the brothers spend their money as long as they create vast numbers of jobs and pay their taxes. I believe that in a poor country like India, it is more important to remove poverty than to worry about economic inequality. By the way, Das still continues to say that. Das, however, feels apprehensive about the way business people easily get onto the slippery slope, using the phrase, tempering morals with pragmatism. Things have deteriorated to such an extent that people no longer seem to attach any meaning to reaching the end via ethical and moral means. In other words, the popular feeling seems to be, it's okay to cheat and cut corners as long as one does not get caught. What a sad state. And that's not all. Poll after poll conducted amongst young people in recent years shows that the majority of them believe that in today's India, one must learn to live with corruption. Thank God they didn't say, one must learn corruption. Corruption, they all say, is here to stay, even if most people hate it. It is by way of countering that feeling of hopelessness that I brought in Gandhi and his intense belief that means do matter and that crooked means cannot be resorted to just because the end happens to be good. As Swami always reminded us, this goes back to the neem example. If you plant a neem seed, you would get only a neem tree whose fruit stays bitter and not a mango tree that yields sweet mango fruits. This is a simple truth. It just reflects that one reaps as one sows. And people forget that. Many would loudly protest, look, the world of Gandhi is long gone and we now live in a dog-eat-dog globalist world of social Darwinism in which Gandhi has become irrelevant. No point in talking about him. Could Gandhi have prevailed against Hitler? Even there he was of no use. This is the way people argue. It's very easy to line up any number of such counter-arguments against being dharmic. At the same time, let us not be too impulsive in summarily brushing aside the merit of goodness. Please recall Gandhi and the Salt Satyagraha and how it influenced Dr. Martin Luther King, who later successfully marched to Washington, gave his famous address, I Have a Dream, and then what happened? A year or so later, the U.S. Congress passed the Civil Rights Act, outlawing racial discrimination. After the abolition of slavery following the American Civil War, the passage of the Civil Rights Act in America represented the biggest step forward for African Americans, and it was achieved non-violently. In other words, Satyagraha has worked even in faraway America. Now, having said that, it is equally true that laws alone are not enough and that there must be a change of heart also. Sadly, where there is prejudice, law is always far ahead of transformation of the heart. Nevertheless, it is to be noted that America now has a black president, an African-American as a president, which is absolutely impossible to imagine barely 20 years ago. And finally, let us not forget how in South Africa, where Gandhi started using Satyagraha to oppose injustice, his influence was felt almost a century later, when Nelson Mandela took a historic decision in 1944, after assuming office as the first black president of South Africa. Prior to that, Mandela had been imprisoned from 1964 to 1990, when he was released. At that time, the white majority gave up apartheid or racial discrimination and agreed to free elections, as also a new constitution that abolished racial inequality. After assuming the office as the president, Mandela made a historic announcement. For over 100 years, the black had been segregated and humiliated in the land where they had lived for thousands of years. There was so much anger locked up in the blacks that there was the danger of a bloodbath by way of taking revenge on the whites, who were much smaller in terms of population. This was Mandela's moment. Speaking with remarkable wisdom, he said, and this is a paraphrase, "As a nation, we are very backward. Only a very tiny fraction of the black population enjoys a moderate standard of living, while the rest are dirt poor. At this moment, we have two options. One is to settle scores about past injustice. Little would be gained by this. All that would happen is that the country would be pushed even further into backwardness. The alternative is to focus on moving forward by cooperating with the whites. This does not mean we forget what happened in the past. We sit together, black and white, examine the past, accept the truth courageously, but finally reconcile." This was the truth and reconcilement movement. What is important for us is that Nelson Mandela acknowledged the contribution of Gandhi's philosophy made in shaping his decision. Way back in 1927, Gandhiji wrote, "God is truth. The way to truth lies through ahimsa or non-violence." Truth, which is the crown jewel amongst moral values, is identified verily with God. Thus, for the believers, moral values are absolute. That being said, influenced by the amazing achievements of modern science and technology, a very large percentage of people in the developed world, particularly in Europe, have become atheists or at least agnostic. The intelligence here, including in India, emphatically prefer to be libertarians, which means that for them moral values are to be decided by individual preferences. This is called relativism because there is no fixed moral frame of reference, as opposed to absolutism, where there is a fixed reference for defining moral values, and that reference happens to be the Lord Almighty. Upset by the sharp rise in relativism, former Pope Benedict agonizingly referred on one occasion to what is happening presently as the tyranny of relativism. Gurcharan Das is of the view that moral rules and moral ideals have become different functions. To explain what they mean, Das says, "Moral rules are like the Ten Commandments of Moses, which go like, honor thy father and mother, thou shalt not kill, and so on. On the other hand," opines Das, "moral ideals are like the famous Sermon on the Mount delivered by Jesus, which outlines how people could earn the blessings of the Lord by being compassionate, caring, etc. In that sense, the Sermon on the Mount can be compared to chapter 12 of the Bhagavad Gita. Indeed, the sermon as well as chapter 12 both share a wonderfully mystical and an awesome quality. It is no accident that Gandhi admired Christ and his teachings. While in London, studying to become a lawyer, Gandhi made a trip to Paris to see the much-hailed Eiffel Tower that had been constructed in 1889 to mark the centenary of the French Revolution. While the world at large was awed by this extraordinary structure built by man, the famous Russian writer Leo Tolstoy dismissed it as a mere monument to man's folly. Deeply impressed by this contrarian philosophical judgment, Gandhi then began digging deeper and deeper into Tolstoy's later writings, which were all about the love of Jesus Christ. What struck Gandhi most was the core teaching of Christ, which was that the kingdom of God was right within us. And that, let us remember, is also the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita and of course Swami's teachings as well. Seen in this light, it is clear that historically both moral rules as well as moral idealism both had their origins in spirituality and religion. This is true of both the East as well as the West. Concerning the rules and ideals, thus essentially says that it is best for all of us to be good by sticking as best as we can to moral rules. As for moral ideals, they can be treated as some kind of perfection which is hard to attain by us. Therefore, there is no use in trying to be another Mahatma. The average person is not cut out for that. That seems to be the recommendation of Gurchand Das. Now, it's interesting that moral rules and moral idealism referred to above find an echo in Swami's teachings, where moral ideals are somewhat like Swami's Atma Dharma, while moral rules could be the analog of what Swami used to refer to as Paradharma. I must caution, though, that Atma Dharma is a profound and precise principle that is rooted in divinity. But we can discuss all that later. I think it's time to bring this talk to a close. You know, I find it amazing. This is my fourth talk on chapter 1 and I'm still not through with it. It looks like it's going to be a slow trek across the entire book. But in a way that is also good for us because it would give us a better opportunity to discuss various arguments in detail. As usual, I thank you for your patience. I must, however, confess that I am somewhat disappointed that there has been little by way of questions addressed to us. Maybe you are busy, but surely the subject being what it is, there ought to be at least some questions. Offering this talk at Swami's lotus feet, I take your leave. God bless and Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, that brings to an end talk number 4 in the current series on Dharma presented by Professor Jeevankatraman. Dear listener, your questions and feedback are available to us. You may write to listener@radiosai.org. And if you don't mind, kindly draw the attention of people who have missed this program to listen to it by downloading the podcast, which is available on our website www.radiosai.org. Thank you and Sai Ram.